Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's podcast is sponsored by Checkpoint Software Technologies and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. This week's show is all about the issue of mobile device security. Not so much worrying about people owning phones and grabbing data off them, but, you know, what happens when your CEO's shiny new iPhone gets owned by someone who's clever enough to load it up with Metasploit? You know, that gets them onto your wireless LAN and they can start poking around and, you know, that's pretty bad. So we'll be hearing an excerpt from a presentation delivered to the RuxCon Security Conference last year, that presentation by Finbar Davies, followed by an interview with the head of iDefence Labs. His name is Rick Howard. He was on the show last week, and this week we're talking to him about the latest in mobile security trends. In this week's sponsor interview, we'll be chatting with Steve McDonald from Checkpoint Software about firewall optimization and firewall optimization packages. Now, it's not new technology, but it seems to be getting a lot of traction lately because it's basically gotten a lot better. So if you're a firewall optimization software expert, then this interview will probably bore you to tears. But if not, you might actually learn something. This stuff, you know, especially if you work a lot with, you know, compliance-y sort of stuff. It's pretty interesting stuff. Now, alas, there is no news segment this week, and unfortunately, next week's show is going to be a few days late. You can expect it probably on Friday next week. I've just got a bit of travel on at the moment, so it's going to be hard to get everything to fit with the normal publishing schedule. Now we're just going to get straight into our special edition on mobile security issues with this excerpt of a talk by Finbar Davies. Now, Finbar works for Securus Global in Sydney as a penetration tester and security consultant. And he did a talk late last year at RuxCon in Sydney, which was basically about enterprise security. Now, I listened to the whole thing again, and it wouldn't really work as an audio podcast, the whole thing. But I did find the section I'm about to play works quite well, which is the stuff on mobiles. Finbar took a look at iPhone security and had some very interesting observations, as you'll hear.
Yeah, just really stupid stuff. I mean, for God's sakes. Yeah, so I did, for a client, a bunch of testing on the iPhone. And unfortunately, I can't tell you about a bunch of vulns I did find it. Apple asked really nicely not to, and I told them I wouldn't if they bought me a cheap six-pack of beer. I'm a cheap whore, you see. I just thought it was funny. And, yeah, so I thought maybe it's not. They weren't that interesting. They weren't that viable, but they were still pretty serious. But as I said before, there's all these people trying to push it into the enterprise because it looks really pretty and like it's got Exchange support and all the stuff that you would really want in the enterprise. And it's just really not ready for it. One thing it has in there, if anyone's really played around with it, is it has this thing called a dynamic keyboard cache where it's really helpful when you're typing away your keyboard and it remembers some of the words you've used before and sort of goes those first, or ones you might put in that aren't English, like your ghetto slang like I have in there. And it actually keeps all this in this little file called keyboard case. So when you're browsing, I want to, you know, go to my Gmail and type in my username and password. It likes to remember that as well in the keyboard cache. So it's all just sitting there in plain text, not encrypted or anything like that. The iPhone actually does have a hardware AES encryption engine, which is all right, and it's a real bitch to try and get the keys out because you have to modify the bootloader and get it to spit it out, and that's a lot of effort. But it's got a terrible security record. I mean, like, Kuz is gone, but Safari, that's a bit of a joke of a browser, really. It's just got terrible, terrible security record, and that's how you browse the web. And Apple, I mean, they're really good at security. You can ask Nemo about his thing, and then him telling them, like, about 80 different vulnerabilities in, like, their kernel and general operating system. And what's funny, when we were doing this testing, we realized that our iPhone was given a unique IP. I mean, we could see it from the internet. It wasn't behind a NAT or a proxy or something like that. Like, there it was on the internet. And we'd installed SSH because we were, you know, hacking away and pulling stuff off. And because all these when you're transferring files, all the tutorials tell you install SSH so you can use SCP to transfer stuff on there. Yeah, but you don't change your root password, do you? It's really hard. You can't actually type password and then put a new one in. That doesn't work because it's Apple. You actually have to go in and edit the file and use crypt to make the new password and do it. So you can just scan the internet if you want for port 62078, which is like a special Apple port that's used when they sync, when you plug it in, and you put your pictures of your kittens on there. And you're, yeah. And then you look for the SSH, and you just log in, it's root Alpine. And you're now root on their machine, and they've got all their passwords, it has all their mail stored in plain text, it has who you called, where you last accessed the GPS. Every time you press the little home, like the little button in the middle, and there's the nice transitions between stuff, it actually takes a screenshot and then does work on the screenshot to make it look like it's nice. So it keeps all of those for those last screenshot of every single application you've ever used on there. It doesn't delete anything, it actually just overwrites it. So if you delete it, it just goes, nah, it's gone. So there's all the stuff you can pull off. So if you pull off the raw partitions, like over SSH with a nice good 3G bandwidth, you can start carving up their raw partition table with like a tool like Scalpel, which is a data carving tool.
So that SSH server, that's a cracked iPhone, is it?
Yeah, it's a cracked iPhone. Sorry, I should clarify that. But I mean, if you've got an iPhone, why the hell wouldn't you crack it?
You answered that question.
Fun.
Just giving us a good reason not to.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, I mean, you find stuff in other shit too, like that. What was that, port 620, whatever?
That's only active. It's a TCP. It's TCP wrapped until you've synced. I guess you.
Is there anything else open though? Like,
there's some UDP stuff. I'm not. There's some. It's like a mystery port, which no one knows what the fuck it does.
Yeah.
But I was actually really want to try and race like the 62078 port, because it's only active when it syncs, when you plug it in. So there might be like a little race time where you could possibly get in there. But Ivan.
And then the 3G IP, is that static per subscriber?
No, but it's always on.
So basically, yes.
Basically, it's until you turn it off and on. I'm not sure, I don't actually have an Optus one. I've only got to play around with it very briefly, but I have been looking around some iPhones.
When your reception drops out and picks up again, you get another IP.
Yeah.
It's not at all.
Not with Optus. Some it is, like Telstra it is. I can't remember. What else we test?
Three.
Yeah, three's an edit.
Everyone
but Optus. So everyone with Optus. But what's kind of cool about this is that, because you need some really evil stuff, because if you've got SSH installed, the package management system with iPhones to get SSH installed is apt. And there's really helpful people out there making Metasploit for iPhones, so you get installed Metasploit. And then you find MetalStorm where he is, and then you tell him, hey, can I have your autohack.py? And then you get it, so whenever it joins a local network behind all the firewalls and all that sort of stuff, you just tell the iPhone to start hacking everything in great, which would be great for enterprises. So, you know, when the executives are using this and when they jailbreak it and one of them doesn't change the root password or is on Optus, your juicy internal network will be theirs or mine or whoever will do this. So there's going to be a lot of interesting research coming out in the future for this. Also, because we had TCP dump and we're TCP dumping on the 3G port, we saw all these Windows stuff trying to talk to our phone. We're like, what the fuck is going on? And there's all these 3G mobile networks, mobiles trying to pair with our mobile, and so going, hey, do you have anything open? What's happening? How you doing? And the Apple's like, I don't know what you're talking about. So that's kind of interesting, because you have now this trust because you're on the same like subnet, because I don't think mobiles are really designed to be out there on normal networks like this. They think they're on this, you know, cloud somewhere. Like, so I think there's going to be some terrible stuff coming out with mobile hacking lately. Like, there's that Symbian exploitation thing recently, which was very, very cool, I thought. Symbian's pretty hardcore. Yes, I swore. Oh, I didn't write it properly. Yeah, so
that was an excerpt of Finbar Davies' talk at RuxCon last year there, and I should mention that changing your root password on iPhones with version 2 software is actually pretty easy these days. The process Finbar described there was for the version 1 stuff. But it's interesting stuff, nonetheless. Now, I wanted to go a bit deeper on this topic, so I had a chat last week to Rick Howard, the head of iDefense Labs in the USA. iDefense is, of course, a subsidiary of VeriSign and tends to have some pretty interesting things to say on trends and vulnerabilities. So I asked Rick If 2009 would finally be the year that mobile hacking took off, people have been predicting that mobile hacking is going to be the next big thing that's going to kill us all since around 2003. And I even did some technical writing as a consulting gig for a mob who were writing a security package for Symbian. And we're talking 2004. I did this and it just obviously never really took off. So every year has been the year with this stuff. Every single press release with that we get in December as journalists saying, you know, next year mobile hacking is going to be the big thing. It's coming, I swear. And it just never sort of has. So I asked Rick, what about 2009? You know, is 2009 different?
Well, I just want to agree with you, too, that I'm one of those guys for the past 10 years that said mobile phones are going to hit any day now. All right. So maybe it's a good time for your listeners to tune out while I talk. I wouldn't blame them. But let's just say there are forces at work that makes these new kind of smartphones very attractive targets. Mm. Right? And we've already seen attacks on a small scale, not hacking the box like you're suggesting, but, you know, just trying to get at the machine so they can make some money on it. I was listening to Art Mosberg talk on a different podcast. Are you familiar with him?
It does ring a bell.
He is the tech editor for the Wall Street Journal. This is what he said about the what's the difference between a BlackBerry and an iPhone. And I just love this. He said the difference between a BlackBerry and an iPhone is that a BlackBerry is a phone with some SMS trickery, can surf the web in a very small and crude way. But an iPhone is a portable, wireless Unix machine that just happens to do phone calls.
Mm.
All right. So, and that's why I think that these smartphones and, you know, the iPhone and Android clones and those kind of interesting devices that we've seen in the last year or two are very powerful and only get more powerful in a very short amount of time. And I think that's the first factor we need to worry about. Okay, these emerging machines that can do a lot of things get after your network.
Well, in particular, they can connect to WLANs, and it's almost certain that any executive out there is going to want to do that, is going to want to put this thing on the local network so that they can, I don't know, like look up their latest eBay bid on their latest Maserati or whatever.
Well, you know, that's what Mosberg said. The iPhone has essentially stopped all debate in pubs, okay, because no one has to argue about the various trivia and you just look it up on the web with your iPhone.
The Guinness Book of World Records guys must be, you know, devastated.
No kidding. But, you know, let's just talk about basic security a little bit. If you're talking about your CEOs and CIOs and all the guys at the top level, and if they lose their iPhone or they misplace it, what can be gained if some bad guy grabs that and takes the stuff off?
Well, yeah, Rick, you can fix that with policy. I mean, remote nuke on iPhone works pretty well.
I know, but what I'm suggesting is that most people have not even begun to think about that kind of stuff. Just kind of scary. I was at the Department of Defense cybercrime conference last week, and I watched law enforcement guys take an iPhone they grabbed out of the audience and take everything off of it in about 15 minutes with nothing but iTunes. And so I, what I'm trying to suggest is that we, our enterprise people need to start thinking about how to secure those kind of devices.
Okay. And I suppose, look, the other thing that is interesting, I mean, the thing that I find compelling is that you can actually start using these things. Say you own an iPhone, it's got access to the WLAN. I don't know how devastating...
Unix box, what can I say, you know?
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, I imagine you'd also be able to enumerate the, you know, just a simple attack is instead of actually trying to, you know, hack through someone's WLAN, you could just enumerate the WPA key or whatever, have that sent out, and then you can sit outside the building on the WLAN and go at it proper with a laptop with full tools.
But it's absolutely possible to do that, but there's even more simple attacks that we've been seeing here in the last year. It's just the dumb attacks that work the best, and basically sending spam SMS messages to iPhone users and having them click on the link or just respond back to an SMS message, and those SMS numbers are pay-for services, kind of like what you would get if you voted for American Idol or something.
Yeah, no, it's funny you say this. Like, I did some consulting to a guy who was developing a mobile security suite. This is in 2004, and it was a pretty cool little suite for Symbian, but it just never really took off. But he showed me this game that you could download, and part of the terms of service was that when you're playing this game, of course that was all in fine print, while you were playing this game, it would be sending out $5 messages like every minute. So anyone who used this free game was just getting absolutely ripped off, and technically that was legal.
Because they signed the user agreement or something?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we sent some of our guys through Asia this last year because we expect expected to find that kind of thing happening all the time, or at least a lot more hacks going on the mobile platform in that part of the world. And they said what is really the big attack so far on these mobile platforms is those kind of low-level spamming attacks. That's where all the money's being made now.
Okay, that's where the money's being made now. But the thing that makes the iPhones, you know, and other devices of that ilk juicy, as far as I can see, is now you can run Metasploit on an iPhone. You can actually use it as an attack platform. And it's highly ownable. There's no security software on it. It's running Safari, which, I mean, come on, man, you're the head of research for iDefense. You can't say that it's going to put up much of a challenge.
No.
To own that. So, you know, this really does change the game a little bit, doesn't it?
It does change the game, but I don't want to throw Apple under the bus completely yet, okay, because the newest versions of the iPhone, they're running in a trusted code signing environment. Okay, so you can still install apps on that phone, but it's a lot harder to do than, you know, some of the first versions of the iPhone. So it is not like, you know, guys like me and you could do it pretty easy. It's going to take some skill to get these applications on there. But it is possible, and we need to worry about it, that's for sure.
I also wonder whether or not we're going to see similar sort of attack toolkits developed for other platforms like Android and BlackBerry. Do you think that's something where we're going to start seeing Metasploit ports for BlackBerry or for, you know?
Yeah, I guarantee it, because I'm the guy that's been predicting it, you know, it's going to happen every year. I remember that, all right?
So hang on. You're saying, yeah, I can guarantee it because I've been predicting it for years and it never happened.
That's right. I'm going to get it right one of these years, right?
So you think that's a viable sort of threat?
Well, I do. I think it's even more viable for those, for that platform, because that's an open source platform. So any of the hackers out there are trying to do that kind of thing, they're going to get the specs for it right up the front and see where the weaknesses are.
Yeah, well, our buddy Graham Nielsen in New Zealand, who works for Aura Software Security, there you go, free plug, Graham. He did a very interesting presentation at KiwiCon year before last. He basically wrote a Trojan for a BlackBerry and just bought the code signing keys from BlackBerry, from Research in Motion, and signed the package, and then voila, he could install it on BlackBerries.
That's very interesting, okay, very interesting. And on the backside, since we're talking about BlackBerry, we've had our own guys in our labs taking a hack at the back-end server for BlackBerry. And by the way, I want to put a plug in for those guys. When we found those vulnerabilities in the server platform, they fixed it very fast in a couple of weeks and got the patches out, so good job for those guys.
Who's that, Research in Motion?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they did good there.
I suppose the thing is, too, you can revoke the keys once you know that an app is bad, but if you've just signed some custom thing and given it limited distribution, chances are Research in Motion are never going to hear about it.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Mm-hmm. So what do you recommend people out there in userland actually do to lock down their mobile devices? I suppose step one would be to have a really locked down WLAN policy so that even if someone does own one of these things over the cellular network or whatever, they can't really do much with their fully like mobiled out version of Metasploit with, you know, autohack.py on it.
Yeah, I think that the enterprise users are going to be in better shape secure-wise than, you know, the average Joe on the street. But what I think is going to happen with these mobile platforms is this going to hit everybody like a ton of bricks, okay, because the applications for these things are going to start pouring in that everybody's just going to want to use. I was in South America in August this year watching a demonstration of a new way to use a mobile platform, and this is very interesting to me. You go to a grocery store, you buy your groceries, you go up to the cashier, he rings up the charges and sends you an SMS text with the bill. You get it, you put your PIN in and return the message, and your grocery bill shows up on your phone bill at the end of the month.
So you mean someone's actually going to finally find a positive use for GSM hacking?
Exactly right. So that's where the money is, right? As soon as you start using the mobile platform to do money transactions in a big way, the bad guys are going to find their way over to the mobile platform.
Rightio. So you would anticipate that as those billing systems get rolled out, more people are going to have an incentive to actually own the device and start fiddling with stuff on each end?
Exactly. And that's what I think is going to happen.
Yay. Oh, well, at least it's going to keep everyone in a job.
Well, that's what I look forward to. You know, I want a little job security over here in the U.S., so I'm happy to hear it.
All right, Rick Howard, once again, thank you very much for speaking to us.
No problem.
That was Rick Howard on the line from the USA there, rounding out this week's discussion on mobile security. Now it's time for our sponsor interview with Steve McDonald from Checkpoint Software. Each week, we let our sponsors come onto the show to have a bit of a chin wag. Before we get going, I'd like to just point out that after we did this interview, which was done last week, Steve mentioned that he planned to cancel his Valentine's Day plans with his partner to volunteer at the site of the horrible fires we've experienced down near Melbourne. And I just think that's worth mentioning. And he definitely deserves an attaboy on behalf of Risky Business. And I'd also like to say a big thanks to the listeners who donated money to the Red Cross Appeal following last week's podcast. Some of them weren't even based in Australia. So well done, guys. It all helps. That's really good. And the amount of money donated to that appeal has just been quite extraordinary. So that's a little bit of a silver lining on, admittedly not much of a silver lining, but it's a small silver lining on that cloud. But look, back to the topic at hand, and I thought it would be interesting to have a chat to Steve about the latest in firewall optimization technology. As you'll probably guess from the questions you're going to hear me ask, Steve, I don't really know much about the topic, but I do know that it's been getting more attention in the press and on the grapevine than it used to. Now, the basic idea behind firewall optimization software, which is made by companies like AlgoSec and Tufin, is that you can track changes in firewall rules and make sure you're still getting a nice big tick compliance-wise. They can optimize performance. They can do a whole bunch of stuff and even integrate with your security information management stuff. So I started off by asking Steve to explain in basic terms what firewall optimization suites are good for.
Yeah, look, they kind of fall under a few categories. Checkpoint and other vendors out there obviously make security products, whether it be firewall or IPS, and a number of others, and then we need technologies then to either make sure that the policies we write are as efficient as possible, not only as secure as possible, but as efficient as possible, and also from an auditing perspective as well, there's a lot of work to be done there to keep our regulators happy in the industry as well.
So I guess it's about you'd use these solutions to get the most out of your firewalls and also to hit sort of audit points and things like that.
Yeah, look, it's quite simple. Obviously, a firewall rule base is normally processed top to bottom. If you can put in a high-performance firewalling environment, if you can put your most often used rules towards the top of the policy, just by very nature, you'll get a little bit more performance out of the firewalls.
So really, it's about extracting performance, or is it really about making sure that your rule sets are right and all sort of agree with each other?
Yeah, look, there's definitely those two elements in there, and this is where it gets a little bit more tricky when we're talking about a cross-vendor firewall solution where you've got Checkpoint firewalls and other third-party firewalls within the environment. It becomes very hard, first of all, from a performance point of view, to make sure the firewall policies are tuned. But from an audit and compliance point of view, it's very difficult once you start deploying multiple types of firewalls in an environment. And this is something that Checkpoint recognised quite a while ago as needing a lot more work and something that we've been doing a lot of work in our OPSEC partner alliance in that specific area.
Well, look, it seems like some third parties have actually stepped into the mix. We've got vendors like AlgoSec, Secure Passage and Tufin. I don't know how that's pronounced, but this seems to be a product area that would logically be handled by non-firewall vendors because they have to get across so many different vendor technologies. Do you agree with that, or do you think that you guys will be making a play for that space?
Look, as things stand currently, Checkpoint strongly believes that firewall optimization cross-vendor is best addressed by third parties. Many years ago now, Checkpoint set up OPSEC, which is our open platform for security. People can have a look at opsec.com, which basically publish all of our APIs freely and give support to anybody who wants to interoperate with Checkpoint products. We provide free software, free access to all the APIs and various other elements. And Tufin and AlgoSec, RSA, Symantec, IBM are just some examples of third-party development houses and various other solution providers who certainly participate in that OPSEC forum.
Yeah, no, I imagine, you know, if it was my job to actually try to maintain some sort of consistency across, you know, say Cisco PIX, Checkpoint, NetScreen, whatever, you know, Juniper or whatever they're called these days, it would be pretty challenging, I'd imagine. Are all firewall vendors quite open in the same way? Do they all have the same sort of APIs that allow third-party vendors to help optimize their configurations?
Look, there are some really good vendors out there, and there are some that aren't so good as well, and the majority are leveraging common things like SNMP capabilities or syslog capabilities to provide standards-based interoperability capabilities. but it's certainly a challenge. And let's not forget that many customers out there are still doing per device management, and they still haven't gone to that level of the overriding management platform that's not just looking after one element. So, you know, it's going to be a long road ahead for those customers to actually not only go from single device management, but then manage the multiple devices using managers and then have a manager of managers.
So do these optimization products, they actually actively manage the device as well, not just, they don't just sort of spit out recommended rule sets and things like that?
There are some that plug in and can directly interact and with the policy and make changes. But by and large, we see most of our customers who are going down this path deploying them in a segmented manner, so they're getting alerting and they're getting reporting and they're getting reports out of the environment to make sure the compliance elements are right, that rule-based notes are kept up to date, that there's no conflicting rules, that overriding business rules are honoured and maintained in products like TUFIN and AlgoSec. And I actually met with both of those specific vendors in Israel when I was over there recently, and they obviously got some really strong roadmaps to take that type of technology to the next level.
Mm-mm. Now, how recent is this sort of technology? Is firewall optimization something that's been around for a long time and is just starting to become quite popular now? Or where's the technology at?
Yeah, so I've been working with the TUFIN products and AlgoSec products now for quite some time. It's nothing that's that new, but where the driver here, or where Checkpoint believes the driver here is, the operational groups in our customers, the maturity that we've seen developing, particularly over the last 2 years, has been very, very significant. And that's more to do with, as people have become more cost aware, they're trying to drive down costs of a lot of different solutions and trying to reduce the amount of humans they need to configure systems and trying to remove a lot of risk out of systems as well. So it's almost like a maturity element in the industry where we see these kind of top-level management solutions coming in. And each vendor has an area to play here. I mean, we've talked about file optimization and security policy auditing, but then you start looking at security event management, where most of the vendors out there, including Checkpoint, have cross-platform capabilities to do with security event management, which is about, you know, taking an action from a security event.
Steve, do you think these vendors should be trying to build management capabilities into their products, or do you think they should just stick with the monitoring and reporting?
Yeah, look, that active management element is going to be a challenge. Checkpoint believes strongly that you'll get the best out of a product when you're using that product's administration console to look after it. To try and do a top-level management and an active push-down is going to be problematic from a few different areas, but if a vendor releases a new fix to a product issue and that then causes an interoperability issue between the third-party solution, then there's a lot of areas where the system could break down and we could have some very unexpected results. So we'd like people to proceed with caution with that side of security management.
So you believe there's still a cost benefit by just using the auditing capabilities and the compliance checking capabilities of the products without necessarily getting them to manage devices?
Oh, without question, and particularly in the current market, I've already seen it where many of our customers are now looking at a lot more functionality elements, trying to turn on features that they've never considered before to try and get as much as they can out of the existing environment or existing product set by being able to then put top-level solutions for doing audit control over there to track those changes to make sure that when they're made, they're in line with business practice and the security policy, which hopefully everybody has defined. We believe there's a lot of scope there to make sure that you can contain a lot of cost and particularly a lot of business impact cost, which is intangible, but it's always a risk. Whenever you turn on a new functionality element in any product, it's got to go through a rigorous testing phase. It's got to go through your normal pre-pilot, pilot and deployment. And people can skip those when they're trying to act quickly and they're trying to act with a cost-sensitive mind. It's those kind of technologies which will be the last line of defense.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have to actually audit individual devices anymore as well. I mean, that would be where the effort saving comes in. But, you know, like you, I see the idea of having a, you know, single console to manage your firewalls as being somewhat problematic from a security point of view. I mean, you know, can you imagine a juicier target than the master firewall controller?
Yeah, look, that would certainly be a problem. I can see, though, a lot of benefit in that single monitoring and alerting capability. A lot of our customers have tried to drive these kind of solutions out in the past by deploying an OpenView system or so many other solutions out there. And as yet, we haven't found that perfect manager of manager, but these are good steps. These kind of products are doing some good work in that particular environment, and just raising flags where flags need to be raised, that's a very important aspect.
Well, it seems just from talking to you that it would make sense to integrate products like AlgoSec and Tufin into your security information event management systems, because, you know, it's the same sort of data. I mean, if you could get those systems to report changes and, you know, compliance problems directly to your SIM console, that would probably be pretty cool.
Yeah, look, that's why with our SIM product, which is the Aventure Analyzer product, we can take in feeds from third-party sources, and it's fully customizable by customers to be able to do that kind of thing if that's what they'd like. Mm. And once again, the list of products that we support currently with that is quite long and extensive. But, you know, whenever you get involved in a security event management discussion with any customer, they'll throw out the most obscure technology they'd like you to support.
Do you support Apache on Xbox?
Pretty much. Hold on. But, yeah, that's why we've our solution and many of the others as well in the industry, obviously, are very extensible, and people can get in there and get quite low down and write very specific things and very custom things.
All right. Well, Steve McDonald, thank you for joining us to discuss firewall optimization, the black art.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Checkpoint Software's Steve McDonald on the line from Melbourne there with a look at firewall optimization technology. Checkpoint are, of course, a major sponsor of the Risky Business Podcast, so a big thank you to those guys. And that's it for this week's show. If you have any feedback or comments in regard to any of the topics we've covered today, you can leave a message at our voicemail box in Sydney, 02-8569-1835. Or USA, toll-free on 877-688-8417. And we can take your feedback and play it in next week's audio mailbag. As I mentioned at the top of the show, next week's podcast may be a few days late, but it will hopefully be up on Friday. Until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Justify.
Shoveled in a wet bag of field mice.